holidays from all of us at the Environment, Lands, and Resources Practice Group at Bracewell. We're excited to have you tuning in for our holiday episode. I am joined today by Tim Wilkins in our Austin office, by Jason Hutt in our DC office. He's the chair of our practice group, and Ann Navarro, also in DC. She is the flair of the practice group. Welcome, all of you. I'm excited to sit down with you and discuss looking back at 2022, looking ahead at 2023, and some of our favorite things for the holidays. So, Anne, I'd love to start with you. If you had to define 2022 in just a couple of words, what would you choose?
I would say too quiet is how I would define 2022 in many respects, at least in my area. We've had no Waters of the United States rulemaking out of EPA. We've had no greenhouse gas guidance from the Council on Environmental Quality. We've had no National Environmental Policy Act round two rulemaking out of CEQ. We've had no revisions to the Corps Nationwide Permit 12. We've had no Endangered Species Act Section 7 rulemaking. So too quiet is what I would say.
That's fascinating. Sounds like you have a Christmas list there of things you would have liked to have seen the administration do that. And then all you got was a lump of coal. Well, probably nobody's getting coal from this administration. But Tim, let's go to you. The year in a couple of words and in your explanation.
The triumph of incentives.
Okay. That sounds like a book.
What I have seen this year is companies adopting ESG mindsets, companies tacking to address environmental justice issues, and an acceleration of deal making and investment in energy transition issues, all of which are being led by dollars and concern about dollars. The ESG stuff, folks who are in even the heaviest and fossil intensive industries are talking an ESG game that they didn't used to, because the market needs to know that folks are adapting to a world where climate change is a reality, where there will be a transition towards renewable and greener and carbon capture instead of the traditional blowing and going of the fossil economy. Energy transition, there is money pouring into the system on the private sector side and on the public sector side that are really driving substantial change, substantial investment, substantial deal making. All of those incentives are moving us in directions that are addressing what the administration has flagged as its top two priorities. I'm not sure justice would have been as high a priority without the administration's emphasis on it. But the climate issue and the energy transition issue, that's happening with or without the administration. But when you throw the additional dollars from the Inflation Reduction Act, from the bipartisan infrastructure law into that, there is a lot of commercial activity out there chasing those issues. It's, again, you know, the market moving towards towards changes that really 15 years ago, 10 years ago, couldn't imagine.
Jason, your two words for 2022.
Well, I think my themes are a lot like Tim's, right? Environmental justice has been a huge piece of this. You saw that coming out of the election of 2020 and sort of the racial tensions in the country manifested themselves in the environmental world as an environmental justice policy initiative. And then that initiative, and ESG sort of has an overlap with that, particularly the S in ESG has an overlap with that. And so not only are you seeing the government's actions sort of try to increasingly bake in how environmental justice and social policies should be taken into consideration, whether it's a permitting decision or an enforcement decision or a rulemaking decision. But you're also seeing that because the laws have not changed and because environmental justice does not have a home in a statute, that the government is deploying its money in ways that are designed to achieve the social policy agenda items that priorities that it has identified. So as a result, you know, whether that means simply just the enforcement resources of EPA, you know, check. Does that mean when you're bidding on offshore wind leases and you need to make commitments to local communities where you get you're basically credit bidding for those commitments, you know, check. You know, you see lots of circumstances where if the government is anywhere in the triangle of providing people with rights or permitting someone to do something or enforcing existing laws, that those social policy initiatives are permeating through that process. And as a result, you know, I think that has been a theme for me for our clients for the entire year. It's not going to end on December 31st, I can tell you that.
That's true. And that kind of goes to my couple of words for 2022, which are collision course. I think that we are on one, and I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in 2023, because Jason, as you explained, some of these policy initiatives, some of these concerns from the administration don't have a natural fitting home in a statute. And I think with one of the things that we've talked about on this podcast several times is that maybe the previous administration's most significant regulatory reform, I'm using air quotes, was actually the previous president's judicial appointments and the particular philosophies that those judges have and the kinds of decisions they're going to be issuing when some of these policies from this administration that, again, don't have a natural home in any statute are inevitably challenged. I also think, too, there's another collision course theme with all of the incentives for greening the energy space and completing the energy transition, or at least getting further along that road. We're still dealing with some of Anne's concerns about what role does permitting play? What role does NEPA play as we try to transition towards a greener energy economy? So I think that's going to be really interesting to see what happens as, on the one hand, the administration wants to ensure that we're taking into account climate change, environmental justice concerns, and so forth, and at the same time is trying to ensure that we actually have a pretty significant expansion of infrastructure. So I thought that was great. Lots of great concepts, lots of great themes to track over this year and over the coming year. What, Anne, were your top three most notable environmental and natural resources developments over 2022?
Well, there's so many, actually, despite the fact that I said it was a quiet year in some respects. Obviously, it was not in many other respects, from the Supreme Court to Congress to actions at various agencies. But I have picked three things that I think go along with a lot of the themes that we've been discussing. First, the Inflation Reduction Act and its implications for oil and gas development on public lands, I think, is a significant development because, as you may recall, in that act, Congress required a certain amount of oil and gas leasing as a predicate for wind and other renewable energy approvals and leasing on public lands onshore and offshore. It's yet to be seen whether that's really going to result in more oil and gas leases being issued in this administration. But it's certainly an unprecedented way of using a statutory authority to protect an existing and traditional energy industry. The second thing I would mention, and this may be kind of out of left field, but the listings, endangered species listings of a couple of bats. And those are significant because their habitat is so widespread, especially across the eastern half of the country. And it has really meaningful implications for onshore wind in particular, and for the ability of wind developers to make investments in onshore wind projects and to operate those projects in an economically feasible way. And I think the Fish and Wildlife Service is still working through a lot of the parameters as to what kind of information they're going to be considering and what kind of requirements might help operators operate despite those listings. But those are pretty significant developments. And I think we're going to see more of that type of development that impacts renewable energy and the energy transition that this administration also supports. And then the third thing I will say, and I think I have three and a half things, but the third thing I will mention is, of course, the first Biden rulemaking under the National Environmental Policy Act, because even though the administration only made a handful of changes to the Trump administration NEPA rule, they were certainly very significant in that CEQ brought back consideration of cumulative impacts, which historically has been one of the most challenging things for federal agencies and applicants to deal with, and kind of also a litigation-rich environment because of the difficulty of defining the scope of cumulative impacts. So even though under the Trump administration rule, there was still some consideration of those types of impacts, it's been kind of brought back to a central and key consideration. Also in that rulemaking, even though what the administration did was go back to some of the original regulatory language, in rolling it out, they made clear that they think the role of the agencies is really to think big, even in terms of private projects that are just coming in for some sort of permitting, to think about the role of those projects and to think hard about alternatives to them. So it'll be interesting to see how various agencies interpret CEQ's various statements in that regard. I think some won't change, whereas some may view it as an opportunity to take a broader look at some of the private projects that come in front of them. And then in terms of the half, I will just mention the Sackett Supreme Court argument, because even though they haven't yet issued a decision on the scope of waters of the U.S. under the Clean Water Act, it was a very interesting oral argument and a highly anticipated decision. So that was certainly a notable event in 2022.
And if you're curious about what was said in that oral argument, you could go back on whatever podcast streaming platform you use and check out our breakdown of that discussion. Tim, your top three for 2022.
So my top one is the biggest. And I can talk about two other things, but the one I want to focus on is gasoline prices. We had gasoline prices go through the roof, going from $2 something to $5 something, but then magically coming back down below $3. I guess there are two developments there, but they are obviously interlinked. I think the rise in gasoline prices and the political fallout from that, the economic fallout from that, really did damage to some of the greenest folks' ambitions to move as fast as humanly possible away from fossil fuels and towards electrification and renewables. There's a reality there that transitions take time. They take adjustment. And when people freaked the heck out over the hike of gasoline prices, which obviously had many causes. Energy markets are complex. They're not simple. They don't respond to one lever. But when those prices went up, I mean, it kind of changed a lot of games for a lot of people. And then as the energy prices came back down, I drove past $2.39 a gallon on my way into the office. The idea that Joe Biden killed the Keystone XL pipeline and that's why gasoline is $5, the dumbest arguments from the other direction also suffer greatly from the real world and those developments. I think that up and down cycle and the struggle to find handholds to help address energy prices, the reality that we are not moving entirely to electrification tomorrow, that this is a transition, it's not an abrupt change, even if it's accelerated, I think puts a little bit of complication on ideological arguments from both directions and brings us back to the reality that energy markets are complex. There's a transition going on. There are going to have to be adjustments as we go to smooth out the difficulties that result from the transition, just plain and simple. Other two developments I'd point to, Administrator Regan's Journey to Justice tour, bringing a spotlight to environmental justice generally, but also to very specific facilities and very specific issues in a way that has never been done before by somebody at that high level within an administration. I think that really scores a lot of points and creates a lot of momentum for an agency that has historically struggled with what to do about environmental justice. We care about it, but what are we going to do next? How are we going to make it happen? And I think Jason has already talked a little bit about how that's begun to manifest in not only policy, but action. And then last but not least, Ann mentioned the Inflation Reduction Act, the portion relating to fossil fuel and leasing and so forth. But $400 billion into clean energy investments on top of the $70 billion, from the BIL. That's big dollars. And again, I think that's a huge development in terms of accelerating the transition, accelerating the development of stuff that's going to make a meaningful dent in our CO2 emissions and otherwise.
Jason, your top three.
I think that just picking up on what Tim said, you know, that from the journey to justice wasn't just sort of an emphasis on taking to task the regulated community when it came to environmental justice concerns. And so there's a whole new front, and that is the Title VI letters that are going out from the agencies, mm-hmm. not to the regulated community, but to the state regulatory agents, and saying, hey, we have concerns about whether or not you are implementing your permitting program in a discriminatory way. So let's just pause for a second on cooperative federalism and how much that changes the landscape, right? Because the notion when we passed our environmental statutes was that the states were going to implement permitting programs that were at least as stringent as the federal program. And the federal government was going to receive submissions from the states and rule upon whether or not that program was at least as stringent as the federal program, and then delegate the authority of that permitting program to the state and preserve its oversight authority as the state implements it. That's the cooperative federalism that was worked out under the federal environmental statutes. Well, lo and behold, it turns out that notwithstanding the fact that those state programs were deemed to be at least as stringent as the federal program, and notwithstanding that the federal government maintains the same oversight authority over the implementation of those federal programs and how they've been implemented, it turns out that only the states have concerns about whether or not they have been implementing those permitting programs in a discriminatory way. And that really changes the dynamic between a state regulator and a federal regulator. So that tension is very different than I think what we observed in the past in terms of how one worked with the federal government and the state government in obtaining permits, amending permits, and complying with permits. And so you're going to see that play out significantly over the next year. But the notion that those programs have been implemented in a way that was discriminatory towards a particular class of people is very different. It's not just the EPA taking its concerns to the regulated community. They're taking it to the state regulators, and that's a big change. That would be number one to me. Is that's a real shift in the landscape, and highlighted the Inflation Reduction Act and some of its impacts, but there are a lot of other things in there that are very significant that are market movers for our clients. So, you know, carbon capture sequestration, changing the price of a sequestered ton of carbon, changing whether you need tax equity investors involved in those opportunities is really shifted the marketplace and the sort of the rush to try to provide the market with solutions that can take advantage of those tax credits. The hydrogen economy has been catalyzed by the IRA, the solar incentives that are in the IRA. So we're seeing a lot of movement because of that statute. And again, sort of picking up on my first comment, like that's a theme, right? That the legislative agenda is aligning with the White House's agenda in using the deployment of financial incentives to achieve sort of social or bigger policy initiatives. So I would say that's probably my top two, you know, things that are happening in the marketplace. I would say if there's a third, you're seeing big picture, you're seeing the super majors move away from the upstream world. Right. So if you look at some of the sales that happened on the West Coast and in the Gulf of Mexico, you're seeing them less interested in being sort of heavily carbonized. And so that's pushing those assets into less capitalized companies with smaller balance sheets. So the tension, the problem that we've always had in relation to the under assured decommissioning obligations or end of life obligations associated with those assets becomes a greater problem when they're in the hands of entities that have smaller balance sheets. And the government, I think, knows that it wants to tackle that, and they've made noises about that. But as Tim noted, gas prices were the biggest theme, probably the biggest theme of 2022. And so a phrase that Scott Siegel in our office here has coined, at least in my mind, which is, well, what's the coin of the realm in Washington, D.C., right? What's the one thing, the White House doesn't want to do. And what they didn't want to do in 2022 is do anything that would be perceived as raising gas prices, right? And so, you know, mm-hmm. the policy need to address decommissioning obligations, how they are calculated, how the assurance is put in place, how much cash collateral is there in relation to those decommissioning obligations. Those issues have been put on the back burner because to take action on them that would increase the obligations of upstream companies to provide financial assurance or cash collateralize that financial assurance would have been decried as raising gas prices. And so, but lo and behold, as Tim said, they're back down again. So we'll see, you know, what the policy initiatives are going forward. And you saw that too. Like, I don't know how much you can really take out of the conference of parties, but obviously we had another conference of the parties on climate change. And I think there's some recognition that came out of that, that natural gas is not going away in terms of being part of the solution for climate change. Now, can you have lower carbon intensity natural gas? Yes. But, you know, what's going to happen on the European continent this winter will be really interesting to watch in terms of what it does from a, you know, global markets perspective on energy. And, as Tim said, it's not a simple market. It's a very complicated market. Those are, I think, fun things to have watched in 2022 that have really impacted like what our clients are doing and where the capital is being deployed.
Well, I'm thankful for the complexity of those markets because I've got some travel coming up and I'm looking forward to putting more affordable gasoline in the vehicle. My top three for this year included the rise of environmental justice, which we've talked about quite a bit, as well as the Inflation Reduction Act. But one of the things that I'll add for my third top item of 2022 is just the Supreme Court's decision in West Virginia versus EPA. I think that's going to be a really interesting case to watch to see how it gets used. And so I'm looking forward to that. Quickly, as we look forward to 2023, what are some of the things we are likely to see next year coming from this administration? Anne, we'll go to you.
Great. Yeah, I'm just going to give a few quick top hits that I'm expecting, and I am expecting 2023 to be less quiet. In conversations with various folks in the administration, I know they're really being pushed hard to get out priority things. Well aware that they've got 2 years left and some of these things are going to need to go through litigation, and they would like to do this and that in this administration, given the unknowns about the next one. So I think the things we're going to see are a second rulemaking under the National Environmental Policy Act that could be quite controversial. The NEPA rules have always stayed away from calling out particular types of impacts, but I think it's very possible that this administration will specifically address climate and environmental justice in the NEPA rules that are broadly applicable to all agencies. We're clearly going to see some action on the Clean Water Act and the definition of waters of the United States. I keep expecting the administration to issue the rule, which I think is ready to be issued, is my understanding. But at this point, it's going to come quite close in time with the Supreme Court's decision in Sackett. I'm also expecting on the renewable side, the Department of the Interior to finally get around to issuing new rules for offshore wind projects, which are of high interest as well. So I think it's going to be an active 2023.
Tim, what are you looking forward to in 2023?
In furtherance of the administration's priorities, more and better on methane, more and better on chemical and other industrial facility accident prevention, incident prevention stuff. Those are biggies. I think conceptually, you expect to see more regulatory activity than legislative activity. I think there's been much made of the fact that the House flipped from Democrat to Republican control, but with the narrow margins and the filibuster over on the Senate side, I mean, it's not like we saw radical environmental regulatory statute making in the last Congress. It was very much, you know, things like funding and incentives, not wholesale rewrites of AIR Act, Water Act, et cetera. And that part's going to continue. It's going to be regulatory action to some extent on the rulemaking side, but I think a lot of it will be on the enforcement side as well. I think it'll be continued priorities trying to address issues that are on point for the administration's biggest picture priorities on climate, justice, fence line community safety, and things like that.
Jason, what are you looking forward to in 2022 from this administration?
I think we should be watching for an expanded view of emergency authority from the administration. You kind of have seen some hints of that already. But, you know, in the absence of legislative action to provide the administration with the ability to do some of the things that it wants to do, it is taking a more expansive view. And we've seen this at the state level, too, of what constitutes an emergency. You know, I think we traditionally think of an emergency as sort of something that springs out of an unplanned sort of set of circumstances and gives rise to, you know, a peril, an immediate peril to human health or the environment.
Like a natural disaster.
That's a good example. A hurricane, although, you know, we plan for hurricanes now. And I think, you know, inside of the statutes that are on the books, there are authorities for the government to respond to emergencies without, you know, sort of a broader justification under the regulations. And so if the government sees a long simmering emergency that they can't get resolved through compliance requirements or legislative action, you're going to see a more expansive view of what constitutes an emergency and see whether those authorities can be stretched to apply in those circumstances. And you can see the NGOs are pushing that authority too by filing complaints with the government saying that there are circumstances and there's in these communities that constitute emergencies, even if they're sort of long simmering concerns about the presence of a particular type of contamination or the impacts of a particular operation in a community and how and what concerns they have. So I think we're going to see that play out here in 2023 in particular, because, you know, there will be a finite period of time in which the government, this administration, has to act in responding to those concerns. And so bringing those types of claims in the courts will be something that we'll want to watch.
For me, I personally am expecting to be spending quite a bit of time in the Federal Register training my associate eyes on those three columns of new rulemakings that Anne has alluded to. And I think we're going to see quite a lot. One other thing that I thought we might be seeing, especially as the Senate has shifted in power just slightly, I think we are going to see more judicial nominations from the Biden administration catching up. I think the statistics are that President Biden has been keeping pace basically with what we saw from President Trump, who was nominating judges as quickly as he could. So it'll be interesting to see to what extent that changes the playing field for a lot of these disputes.
I believe some of those went through last night.
That's right. I saw some news alerts about those,
including our partner, BJ Shanker, was confirmed a deserving candidate.
So one final question as we look forward to 2023 before we get to some light items. But if you could put something on a company's New Year's resolution list, what would it be? Anne?
I would say keep developing those relationships within the federal agencies that you're dealing with. I think it's easy maybe to perceive federal agencies as faceless permit processors, but obviously everybody's got their own personality, and those personal relationships I have seen be key in getting through difficult permits, leases, other authorizations, raising difficult issues.
Tim, what are you adding to a company's New Year's resolution list?
Searching, creative, thoughtful self-critique, watching what's happening in the world around you and adapting your self-governance to these developments. New technologies for detecting pollution are existing. New scrutiny on issues like EJ are coming into play. Our same old compliance assurance and management system mechanisms are not adapted to the changes that are happening external to the companies. And I would just encourage people to do candid evaluations of their compliance under this new sort of set of technologies, under the new set of scrutiny that you're getting. Make sure that the processes, that your objectives are updated, that your opportunities for improvement are identified broadly, creatively, and in furtherance of this stuff that is on the horizon, but it's a horizon that's arriving very quickly.
Jason.
I think that my theme would be along the lines of communication, public education. I think that the sort of the roles of the trade associations in DC over time have been diluted because of resource constraints and common denominator sort of challenges. And so as a result, and sort of correspondingly, there's been this tremendous uptick in information news that's out there that is not necessarily generated by from an industry perspective or explaining the industry in a factual way. And so just the resources and attention that's brought to that has diminished or isn't in proportion to what's sort of out there from other sources. And so that's putting us in the industry in a difficult position because people just don't understand what they do, how they make what they make, what their environmental profile is, what they do to reduce their environmental profile, how they interact with their community. Maybe 15 years ago, license to operate was a really big theme and we talked about it a lot in the space, but I think it's taken a diminished role in terms of being a priority for the company to talk about itself in the public space and explain what it does. And so I think that all of us can do a better job of that so that help people understand that part of the discussion so that good policies can be set. I mean, certainly fence line monitoring and community monitoring that Tim picked up on in his comment, absolutely true. And there's great and new technologies out there to help with that. But I think that can help to explain positive message to the community, not just be used to sort of weaponize information against the regulated community. So I'd like to see, you know, folks get lean into that a little bit more than we have been in the past few years.
I think mine follows Tim's comment. I think of New Year's is a great time to check in with yourself, to check in with how you're doing. And I think about auditing in that context. And I also think about with all the stuff we've talked about just in this episode about what we're looking for in 2023. I sort of think 2023 is going to be a challenging year with lots of new rules and enforcement initiatives from agencies and a Justice Department that are now, you know, this is not their first rodeo with something like environmental justice. If they're pursuing an environmental justice based action against a company, they're going to be better at it. They're going to be more sophisticated at how they approach those kinds of things. And so I think about it as sort of almost like an exam year, and every time I took an exam in college, I had to clean my room first, right? I had to clean up everything and put it where it belonged so then I could focus on the challenge that was in front of me. And I sort of think about auditing as a little bit like cleaning your room, making sure that things are functioning the way they need to be. And so that is my addition to a New Year's resolution list for our valued clients. Well, thank you for those insights. Before we go, I wanted to do a quick lightning round on some of the things that we look forward to in the holidays, because this is a holiday podcast. And I know that we're all getting excited to spend some time with friends and family. Anne, I'm going to go to you. What is your favorite holiday tradition with friends and family?
Well, I have to say for me, it's decorating the Christmas tree. And that's because I'm kind of a pack rat, right? So I have a lot of ornaments that were mine as a child. I have a lot of ornaments that belong to my parents. And my children also have ornaments that they remember being given as children. And we enjoy unwrapping them together. It's like greeting old friends and, you know, finding just the right spot on the tree for the favorite ornaments. I really enjoy that. This year, my son was not home for that, but my teenage daughter remarkably still enjoys that. Even though she doesn't always like her mother, she still enjoys decorating the tree.
Tim, favorite holiday traditions?
So not holiday specific, but a holiday season. Amy and I host every year the Crappy Bowl weekend. It is the first weekend of college football bowls where you have a bunch of teams from off conferences and 6-6 records going head to head at the famous potato bowl or the tropical smoothie bowl. And it always makes for an entertaining time. We'll put up a TV on the driveway and make a crock pot full of queso and watch the worst college football available.
I want an invite to the Crappy Bowl.
Jason, favorite holiday traditions?
You know, I really just think my favorite holiday tradition right now is the fact that things slow down a little bit. So kids' sports stop for a couple weeks and it just causes everyone in my house to recharge their batteries a little bit and use the weekends differently as opposed to just kind of a transportation logistics process. Like we're spending time. We're actually going to get in the car and drive to Florida as we usually do, but it's nice just to get off schedule and get off the routine and recharge the battery, think a little bit about what's going to happen in 2023. So that's really my favorite holiday tradition, is the fact that things slow down a little bit and you focus on family and friends.
We've got a couple of little girls and we alternate. We go to my wife's family one year and we go to my family the other year. And so the holiday season sort of fluctuates for us, but one constant has been for me is having some friends over and watching Die Hard. I am in my 9th year of doing that annually, and everyone has started to adopt particular roles in this emerging culture of annual Die Hard watching. So we've got the eggnog guy, we've got the cigar guy. It's all pretty fun. Favorite holiday movie, and it doesn't have to be the best holiday movie. You can have a silly holiday pick. Anne.
Well, that's easy for me. And I suppose some people may judge me as silly for this, but there are two. Santa Claus is Coming to Town from 1970, the animated version, and The Year Without a Santa Claus from 1974, the same kind of animated version. And, you know, I don't know how you can't love the songs in those movies, like Snow Miser, Heat Miser. You know, there's the one with the evil snow monster who eventually is singing and walking across the room with the penguins. So those have always been my favorite and probably always will be.
Tim, favorite holiday movies?
My favorite is Elf with Will Ferrell and many others. It's not only sappy and heartfelt, but it's hilarious. I first really fell in love with that movie, having seen it with the kids before, but went to the Alamo Drafthouse where they had a full audience participation version, handing out sleigh bells, handing out bubbles. And it was just absolutely a riotously funny occasion. And I've loved the movie ever since.
You know, the music in Elf is really good, too. It has all of those sort of Christmas pull your heartstrings moments to it. Jason, favorite holiday?
I don't know that we have a favorite. I think we've kind of used the holiday period to evolve the level of movie watching in the house and try to get on some of the great, you know, series. Like we've done Star Wars, we've done Jaws, we've done the Die Hard movies, Lord of the Rings trilogy. So we try to use that time to, like, wherever the age of the kids are, we kind of move up the scale of holiday movie watching. But that's kind of, we use the time to hook them into some movie series and then use the time to watch the movies. The Harry Potter series obviously was early on. So that's kind of what it's been in my house.
I love that. Last year I watched through all the extended Lord of the Rings movies. It was just so great. I think my favorite holiday movie is, despite the fact that I just talked about Die Hard, which I do think is a Christmas movie. There is some debate about that, and we can have a podcast on that separately. But Christmas Vacation, it just, the jokes hold up. The humor holds up. It's so funny. Chevy Chase is incredible. And then finally, favorite dish, dessert, cocktail to enjoy over the next couple of weeks. Anne?
Yeah, that's an easy one for me. Starting in mid-November, I start to buy fresh cranberries by the box load and just always have fresh cranberry sauce on hand. And I have it on everything from yogurt to danishes to ice cream. I just love fresh cranberries.
I did not know that. My daughter loves cranberry sauce. So Anne, we got to talk.
All right.
That's awesome. Tim, your favorite?
Since childhood, peppermint stick ice cream, man, that's something that's only available around this time of year. It's grotesquely sweet, but man, I love it.
Jason.
In case my mom listens to this podcast, I'm going to say it's her mandelbread when I go down and visit her. She makes it during holiday times.
So. And if she's not listening?
Lemon meringue pie.
That's right.
Which she'll say takes too long to make, but I do get, my family usually makes one a year for me. So
over the past few years, I've become a holiday cocktail enthusiast. So I've really enjoyed making Brandy Alexander's, which is my wife's favorite holiday cocktail. But also, I love a quality eggnog, a boosted up hot chocolate. If you've never added some Frangelico, which is a hazelnut liqueur, to a cup of hot cocoa, it is truly wonderful. So thank you all for being on, and thank you, listeners, for sticking with us through the year. It's really fun to do this podcast and to have our audience be a part of it. it's great to know that we are connecting with your interests and your concerns. And it's been really fun to hear from members of our audience. And that's ranged from law students reaching out about thinking about a career in environmental law to seasoned industry professionals appreciating our episodes. So it's really an exciting thing that we get to do for you and with you. So thank you for listening. And thank you, as always, to our production team, Emily, Julia, Dorn, Austin, who keep this show on the tracks. We wish you all a happy holidays. We hope that you have safe travels and that you have a great time, and we'll look forward to connecting with you in the new year. Thanks, everyone.